All right, quick word about Troll Co. Clothing. Here's what I actually love about this brand. It was started by two guys who worked the oil patch. Not marketers, not guys with corporate pitch decks. Workers. They looked around and could not find any clothing that represented the life they were living. So they made it themselves. Workwear, tees, hoodies, hats. Good quality stuff. The whole brand is built around a phrase you have probably heard. Dirty hands, clean money. The idea that hard, honest work is how you build a good life. And I think most people listening to this show understand that better than they're ever given credit for by the sports media machine. So if you want your gear from a brand that actually means something and was not assembled by a focus group, go check them out. Trollco.com/Zabe. That's TROLLCO.com/Zabe. And use code ZABE25 for 25% off your first order. The betting calendar is absolutely loaded right now. Baseball in full swing. NBA, NHL playoffs already underway. If you want to get really spicy, you can even bet the WNBA. Look, I'm not judging. Action's action. The question is, where are you betting? Because that matters just as much as what you're betting. That's why I go to mybookie.ag. And why you should too. New to MyBookie? Use promo code ZABE on your first deposit. If your first bet loses, you get a full refund up to $500 back in free play, plus $25 in casino credit just for showing up. MyBookie.ag, promo code ZABE. Check the site for offer details and to confirm availability in your state. Bet smart, get paid.
What the hell is even that?
Got debacled.
This is the ZABEcast, hosted by a Pop-Tart loving kid from the mean streets of McLean, Virginia. And since you probably have other, more important podcasts to waste your time on, screw those AirPods in tight and let's go.
Here we go. Thursday, July 9, 2026. Thank you for downloading and welcome to Low Tide of the Summer Sports Calendar. Oh, it's not quite full low tide. That'll be the Wednesday after the All-Star game on Tuesday, in which there are no games, except for, of course, WNBA, and there might be a World Cup game. I'd have to look at the schedule. But either way, that's traditionally when the stench of seaweed and dead fish permeates the air of the summer cycle. And while you may dread it and think this sucks, I always get excited because I know when we hit that low tide, the floods are coming back in. The water, the tide is coming back in. And it's going to come back in with force. A little bit at first, and then that big surge comes September, and then it's glorious for yet another cycle. That said, there is always stuff to talk about. And one of the things that we'll be talking about here in the next week or maybe two, although I don't know if it'll drag on that long, is where is LeBron James going to play bouncy ball for money next season in the National Basketball Association? I know many of you are groaning, going, I don't care about this either. I just waded through yesterday's soccer podcast, and I'm going to have to listen. It's okay to take a week off, people. If you don't like soccer, like yesterday was all World Cup and the men's loss, just skip it. You don't have to send me an email groaning about, I don't like soccer, this is too much of your guy, the World Cup guy. I'm playing the hits, in my mind, of stuff that's interesting to me. So, take the day off. Take the week off. Again, you'll come flooding back like the sports come flooding back, much like the dry season in the Serengeti, when the warthogs and the antelopes and the elephants come around the muddy watering hole just to get a dirty sip of water from the mud. I'm dying. I need something. Anyway, LeBron James is going to make his decision somewhere. He's got his agent out there, Maverick Carter, lobbying, essentially. Chris Paul's the player. Rich Paul out there lobbying for various teams, trying to stir up some interest. A lot of considerations for LeBron. He wants to control the narrative of his career because he's obsessed with that. He wants to pick a place where they're going to be good. He wants to pick a place where they're going to be good, but not too good, in which they say, yeah, well, we have LeBron, but we don't need LeBron. He needs to be needed. He's got to be loved. He needs the affirmation. He's got to figure out what's the right narrative of it. And then he's probably got to find a team that can pry open a roster spot for his son. Because, you know, Bronny James is ticketed on a one-way trip to the Shanghai Sharks if he does not go with his dad somewhere. So there's a lot of things in there. I'm interested to see where it is. I don't care necessarily one way or the other. I do have respect for LeBron James and his incredible career and the fact that he was hyped to the moon coming out, and yet he has lived up to, if not exceeded, the hype in almost every way. He's won 4 titles, 3.5 if you want to discount the bubble title, and he's done it in 3 different cities, and it could be a 4th if he cherry picks the right team. Incredible longevity, incredible production. He just doesn't move me. LeBron has never moved me. Jordan makes me go, always, because of how he carried himself and what he represented and just the flash and the style and everything. I'm not going to get into a straight debate about who is better, but just in terms of who I care about as a 58-year-old man, oh, it's Jordan all the way, not LeBron. But 16 years ago to the date on this Wednesday, July 8th, was the decision. 16 years. Now, for those who are too young to remember it, and I'm now starting to work with guys who are almost too young to remember it, Ryan Clary, who produces Middays on WJFK, and it was fun to be with them today, filling in for JP Finley. You know, it was like, I said, do you remember that? You were 10. He goes, yeah, I remember it, but not super well. I'm like, okay, yeah. The decision was fascinating given that LeBron was at the peak of his powers, was at the peak of his stardom. The only problem was he had never won a title. And he had come close. He made the finals with the Cavaliers, got swept. And there was a real nagging desire of, I just don't know if it's going to ever work here, so I might have to leave. So he decides, well, and at the time of the decision, which was a 30-minute TV show hosted by Jim Gray. Jim Gray is apparently a solid dude and a nice guy in the industry, but he's a foof. Like, let's not kid ourselves. Look at the guy. I mean, you really want to hang out and talk to Jim Gray? Apparently solid dude, but whatever. He was the one that brokered this deal and got LeBron James to sit down with him for the decision. And because saying he was going to the Heat only took 12 seconds, if that, you got 30 minutes to fill. How are you going to do it? He also needed the Boys and Girls Club of Akron, Ohio as human shields because purportedly the money raised from this TV show is going to benefit the Boys and Girls Clubs. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Maybe they bought some new Voight playground balls or a trampoline with the money. Who knows? But at the time, nobody really knew. Is he staying? Is he going? What's happening? And so 26 minutes or whatever into the 30-minute special, he finally said the iconic words, I'm taking my talents to South Beach. And it was just cringe the way he said it. It was cringe the conversation between Jim Gray out of nowhere, the foof that he is, with LeBron James in his good boy shirt, this plaid red and white checkered shirt. The notion that he was doing it out of the kindness of his heart for charity, for the kids. It's for the kids. When it was nothing more than just an aggrandizement of LeBron James. This is why I've never been a real fan. It's just too much. It's, whatever. Of course, immediately after he announced he was leaving, the fans went nuts. Talked to him, he's a traitor, he's dead to us, and they burned his jersey. Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cavaliers, put out a screed that is one for the ages, basically saying he's dead to us. How dare he do this? And he put it out in the font Comic Sans, which, as you know, if you have a computer, is a whimsical type of fun font. Comic Sans is the font you use when you say, come on over to the Jacobson's pool party on Sunday. We'll be having watermelon and hot dogs for everyone. Yay! That's Comic Sans. Not LeBron is a traitor, dead to us. Then a couple days later, when they introduced LeBron as part of the big three down in Miami with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, that was over the top. Pyrotechnics coming on stage, WWE-like production, crazed fans. LeBron saying, "Now we're going to win championships. Not one, not two, not three. Got all the way up to seven or eight." Narrator. In fact, they won two, and that was all they would win. Went back to Cleveland, won one with them. City was nuts for it. Good for Cleveland. Then went to L.A., and that was kind of forgettable for the most part. Never really embraced as a true Laker. Tough to crack true Lakerdom when you have so many great Lakers in the past. And for all the Kobe stands, they never really adopted LeBron. Won a championship in the bubble, so that counts.
Why are you doing the air quotes with your voice? Like, everyone can hear that.
I'm not. I'm just saying the words. What do you mean? I don't think there's going to be any big production this time around, but don't count it out. What if, though? What if nobody says yes? Is that even possible? What if they're like, "Yeah, no, we're good. We're good. I know you're still averaging 20 a night, but I mean, we really can't. We don't want to pry open a spot for your kid, and we don't know how many minutes you're going to get. We're already pretty good. Like, maybe the teams that would want him are bad teams, or teams not in sexy cities that he would never think of going to, but." I'm just going to keep out a 1% chance that maybe, possibly, nobody says yes, which would be awkward. I sincerely doubt it. 99% plus, that's not the case, but you never know. You never know. On the soccer front, I've got some further musings about stuff we discussed. I read some think pieces about why men's soccer in the United States is not where it is, and how come we've been 30 years as the future is bright and the future is just the same as it's always fucking been. I've tried to reiterate, it's fine. It's fine where we are. We're trying to grow mushrooms in broad daylight. It's tough conditions, just never going to work. I firmly believe in the unicorn theory, which is our best athletes are like unicorns that get poached by other sports. In other parts of the world, unicorns are a severely protected species. You can't hunt them. You can't trap them. You must let them frolic in the wild, and then they get to play soccer and be brilliant individual artists like Messi, Mbappe, and others. Others are saying, no, no, no. It's not that there's not good enough athletes. There's plenty of good athletes. It's just that they train for and they optimize the wrong way when it comes to American soccer. And they talk about how the goal of American soccer is to get on an elite club team and then get a college scholarship, play in college, and then, boy, if you play in college, that's great. And if you play in the MLS, that's fine, but it's, you know, you still have like a day job because it doesn't pay a lot of money. You're not going to get a $100 million transfer fee like you would if you were over in Europe. So, you know, there's that. There's a lot of elements to it. I know, I just see a lot of pieces, there's a lot of yelling, there's a lot of finger pointing of those that have a stake in this when it comes to getting our national soccer better than it currently is. And it doesn't suck, by the way. It's just not as good as it probably should be. And there's a lot of heat on travel soccer and the cost of it. Hold that thought. But as people are yelling at each other over this, and I've done a little bit of digging and introspection, I am not going to really participate any further. I know there's a variety of factors. I kind of get how they all come together to conspire against us. I hope they can fix some of it. I'd like to be better, but I'm okay with us being what we are. And while everyone's yelling and screaming at each other, I'm just going to like slowly back away. I'm going to close the door to the room and just kind of quietly chunk, just close it. Like, okay, you guys figure this out. And I'll see you in 3 years, 11 months. We'll see. We'll see if you fixed anything. I know the TV numbers were incredible. 42 million plus viewed the USA versus Belgium. That's amazing. Wasn't even a good game. Imagine if it was a great game. Imagine if it was a great game that culminated in penalty kicks and the U.S. won on penalty kicks. Imagine that number then. There's apparently a dispute going on between Telemundo and Fox because I guess Telemundo is starting to steal a chunk of English-speaking fans who literally don't care. They don't understand the words. They just want the inflection of the great Andres Cantor when there's a goal scored. And they're like, hey, we need to separate those people out. You're not supposed to be catching those people. We gave you rights to do the Spanish broadcast thinking, well, that doesn't matter to us, but you're stealing some honkies here. The Argentina game drew a similar massive number. Will they flatten out and tail off as this thing comes to a boil soon? I would like to say probably because we're not in it, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's been a huge success for sure. It was also a huge comeback for Argentina. How big of a comeback? Somebody data mined 10,000 plus international games in various tournaments and the World Cup and found that of teams trailing 2-0 or more in the 79th minute, only came back to win the game in regulation, which Argentina did, 0.16% of the time. Wow. So what you witnessed was a true rare Halley's Comet type comeback. And it was magnificent. Now, there was also a headline that said, Egypt got screwed, but they also choked. I can plus one that sentiment because they did get screwed and they also choked. The two don't cancel each other out. My biggest fear is that VAR, the way it's being used now in the World Cup, which is to have extended reviews that sometimes negate something, a score from earlier in the game, and this we're talking a 100-meter run by the Egyptian player culminating in a pass and a buried strike on the other end, that they could go that far back to go, well, there was a foul that started this. Even though there was, I think, 18 touches somebody counted, 6 defensive maneuvers, and like we said, over 100 meters of distance, you can argue, well, because nobody touched it on defense, that constitutes the possession, and when you change possession and score in a possession after a foul that's not called and VAR looks at it and says, I think that's a foul, then we're allowed to overturn it. I'm afraid that same mentality is going to hop like a virus to the U.S. and our sports, especially tackle football. That's what I fear the most. Because flopping in the NBA was a virus that mutated and then hopped across the ocean from soccer to the NBA. And now we can't eradicate this virus of flopping in the NBA. And we've got guys like SGA and Oklahoma City who are really, really good at it. And it's, I don't want to say it's ruined basketball, but it's made it a lot shittier for sure. So I worry that because this idea is gaining a foothold, like, well, it actually was the right call. I saw several people argue this was the right call. Hate VAR all you want, but it did its job. It did what they said they wanted it to do. To which I say, well, I don't want it to do that. I don't ever want a technicality or a call that might have been wrong, of which there's always calls going to be wrong in a game. I don't want that wiping out a great moment, a great play. That run by the Egyptian player was the stuff of legend. Zigging and zagging and sprinting and dodging and hopping and moving and juking and everything else. Amazing. Why would you take that away? Well, technically, it was a foul. This is sports. Make the calls. Do the best you can. Accept there'll be mistakes. Meanwhile, let's live to watch and appreciate the moments, whether they be good moments for our team or bad moments. It's about the moments. It's not about getting it right. Oh, yeah, one more thing. The men earned $16 million from the prize pool from FIFA for their advancement to the round of 16. $16 million goes to the men's national team in USA. What? What? Half? Half? According to the new rev share agreement with the women's team, they will give half of it to the women's team. And they agreed to this. Why? Reasons. Why? Because the women wouldn't shut up about it. And because the men just at some point realized they couldn't win against the media. The media wouldn't stop banging the drum. The women wouldn't shut up about it. So we're the only nation that shares 50-50 with the women. There may be countries that take their men's prize money and give a chunk to the women's program. We're the only ones that's cutting it in half. Half, Eddie! Of course, part of the deal was that, okay, well, when the women, when they do the World Cup, for their side, you get half of their income. Oh, okay, good. I get half of their income, which is a tenth of the prize money. I'm pretty sure the women could win the World Cup, which they didn't last cycle, and they would still not make even $8 million, much less 16. But don't quote me on that. Don't quote me on that. And then there's this in the whole not now Janice file. MLS put out a tweet congratulating goalkeeper Matt Freeze for making the MLS All-Star team. Yay! I looked at it. I looked at it again. I said, wait a minute. Come on. Really? They're doing this? Like right now, they couldn't like wait a little bit for this to die down? This is the most not now Janice tweet I think I've ever seen. For New York FC, Maddie is a 2026 MLS All-Star. Recognition earned through all the work all season long. And there's the smiling big stork that he is. Good goalkeeper. But what a bad play. And it's never going to get better for all the times it's replayed time and time and time again. Just stuck his foot right in the ground. Some things are better left to therapy. Keith Hernandez, I don't know if you meant for it to come off this way, but most people are reacting like I did, which is, yeah, this was better for therapy, Keith, not for the fifth inning of the Mets game. Now, the Mets are currently a billion games under 500. Their clown show of a season continues apace. So, of course, he and Gary Cohen are going to definitely get off topic at times during the game and let their legs spread out and walk around and whatever, which you can argue either is a good thing or you can argue that, no, I'm here to listen to a baseball game and watch a baseball game. I want them calling the fucking game. I don't want them doing a podcast during the game. Well, Keith Hernandez talked about his genetic lineage and how the bloodline has basically been burnt to the ground and shall not continue.
So I want to get back to the last half inning. You were talking about burning out the line.
Yes.
I didn't think that we could leave that
it's
unattended.
Very convoluted. Jessie, my oldest, has two kids. She's my adoptive daughter. So she's not in my line. So my brother has two kids and they're in their 40s and they're not married. I don't think they're going to have kids. My two in their 40s, they're not going to have kids. I won't go into to one of them how that's not going to happen.
Oh, can you imagine the family group chat after that? Which one is that, Dad? What did you mean by that, Dad?
So the line is...
By the way, game's going on, and this is a 9-9 game at this point in the top of the sixth inning. So against the Royals who had the most comical inside the park Little League home run the other night, throwing the ball all over the field, but it's a 9-9 game.
Burnt down.
Just ended.
I've got two. Jesse's like my own, and Maggie and Charlie are my grandkids, and I love them very much. But
there's ball four, and Collins is on.
There's no passing down. We're done. My brother and I are done. We're done.
That all of your collective athletic skills and your charisma that you and Gary have brought to this earth,
it's
all
just
fizzled out.
It just seems like a terrible waste.
I'd have to say that you're right.
I mean, awkward. I think he meant it in good fun. It's quite possible that the family has joked about this many a time, and it was not a big deal. But some of the reactions include this one. This may be genuinely the darkest stuff Keith and Gary have ever talked about on live TV in their 21 years on SNY. This is awful. I feel for Keith, but this is not appropriate for television. Again, maybe the family's fine with it. Maybe it's a running joke. You're not going to have grandkids. You're not going to have grandkids that are your own lineage. He was blessed with two grandkids from his adopted daughter. That's a blessing enough. You can't be counting these things. You can't be like the nagging Jewish mom. When are you going to get a grandkid for us? You know, if you're lucky enough to have grandkids and they're in your life, and I know more and more of my friends now my age are becoming grandparents, I'm happy for them. You can't be jealous. You can't be keeping score. You can't be saying, well, my lineage is going to be flushed out. And I get it from an athletic standpoint, like, ha, 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 you know. My athletic genius, Keith Hernandez, is not going to continue. He was a ball player. I don't know if there's any great athletic lineage there. All right, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a blackjack guy. Always have been. It's the one casino game where your decisions actually matter. Hit or stand, double down, split. You're not just watching a slot machine and hoping for the best. MyBookie.ag has live dealer blackjack. Real person, on camera, dealing cards in real time. And a full casino beyond that. Roulette, craps, slots, poker, all of it right on your phone. New players get $25 in casino credit just for making a first deposit. Use promo code ZABE. Go try the tables on them. MyBookie.ag, promo code ZABE. Check the site for offer details and to confirm availability in your state. Bet smart. Get paid. All right, joining me now on the ZABE cast, I think one of the most beautiful creatures in sports fandom, and that is the hopeless romantic baseball fan. His name is Ryan Basin, and he has written a book called Death of a Childhood, a memoir of the 1989 Baltimore Orioles, the so-called why not Baltimore Orioles. Despite the title being a bit macabre, Ryan, I'm going to take a flyer and say, you know what? It's not that sad of a book. It's just a great recounting of a magical summer in 1989. Am I right?
Yeah, thank you. It's definitely not that sad of a book. I mean, spoiler alert, the ending's a bit sad. The title kind of gives that away. It really focuses on, you know, that, like you said, it was truly a magical season. It was a team that was poised to become the first team, you know, in Major League history to go from worst to first in one season. And it was a team that was not, you know, unlike some teams that might be that gear up in free agency, it wasn't a team that was even trying to compete. You know, they were expected to lose over 100 games. They threw out a bunch of rookies, castoffs, you know, a bunch of guys that really nobody had ever heard of. All around Cal Ripken Jr. And this is the same year that the movie Major League came out. So it had a very almost like mythical quality to it. And then they go in this run at the end of May, and all of a sudden that vaults them into first place. And, you probably remember this is back in the day when there were seven teams in the AL East and you had to win the division to get in the playoffs. You know, two teams make it in the AL, and there they are. Even in as late as the All-Star break, they're still like 7.5 games up. And then the Blue Jays caught fire, which tended to happen around that time, and had a much more talented team. And it created this, you know, went from this like amazing story where this team's going to go from worst to first and it doesn't look like they're going to be challenged, to all of a sudden they have a real challenger. And then it became, you know, over the better part of the last 2 months of the season, really 2.5, became a real pennant race. Real division race from there. There were a few teams, the Brewers made a run too, but then it really just was the O's and the Blue Jays over that last month, just neck and neck. The lead didn't change hands, you know, more than a game or two over the course of like 3 weeks or something. And then it comes down to this last weekend of the season where the Orioles went into it one game out, a 3-game set in Toronto, you know, at Sky Dome, which was brand new that year and looked like this, you know, looked like nothing else than anybody really had ever seen. not just in a baseball stadium, but really in any sports stadium to that point, at least in the U.S. or in North America, I should say. And then they have these two epic games on Friday night and Saturday afternoon with the division on the line. And, you know, I won't give away too much, but their youth, the Orioles' youth, was tested in Toronto, which had a penchant for choking in those days and had acquired the name the Blue Jays and, you know, really had earned it. Had to stand up too and had to kind of face those ghosts. So it was really, really made for a compelling conclusion to what was just an amazing season to follow, you know, especially as a really young fan.
So back in the day in 89, two divisions, the East and the West, and the Brewers were then in the American League. So they were in the AL East and there was no wild card. And in the NL, they had two fewer teams. So they had two divisions of six. So it was already kind of unfair that you have to fight against six other teams, not just five. And in the AL East, holy shit, you had to fight against the Yankees and the Red Sox. Now, the Red Sox had yet to undo the curse of the Bambino, but still, you're swinging with heavyweights, and you're the Baltimore Orioles. I mean, that is quite an overwhelming thing. And for those that also don't remember, the previous year, the Orioles opened up with a record 21 straight losses. And so the thought that the following year they would get in there with a bunch of ragtag guys to make a run at the division is preposterous. And yes, spoiler alert, you probably looked it up by now if you're listening. They finished two games back at the Blue Jays, and they got nothing for the season. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Good day, as they like to say in Willy Wonka. So you were how old in 89?
So I turned 11. The day before the season started. So fifth grader.
What a great age. Yeah. What a great age. Yeah. Did you play Little League?
I did, yeah. I played played that season. Mm-hmm.
And who was your favorite player growing up? Who was your idol? Cal?
It was Cal, but I was also a Mets fan growing up at the time. So Cal and Darryl Strawberry.
Okay. All right. That's two good choices right there. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rockville, right corner of Parkway and Seven Locks.
Okay. So nice. Yeah. So born in Rockville, Maryland, and grew up there and followed the O's. Of course, this is also when D.C. still did not have a team. So therefore, the Orioles were the de facto team of the district, the DMV area. And I know that I was often badgered, like, you should be more of an Orioles fan, Zabe. And I'm like, from Virginia, there's something about just being over the river that it's a harder reach. It was less hard of a reach, though, being from Rockville. Do a quick jaunt around the top of the Beltway, zip up 95. You were at lovely Camden Yards in no time. So during that summer, how did you follow the team, and how many games did you actually get to go to?
Yeah, so I went to four games that year, including the last exhibition game, which was at RFK. Where they actually played the Cardinals, and then I went to three others during the regular season. There was one, these are all, you know, documented in the book, but there was one against, on Father's Day, we went against Oakland, which were the defending AL champs, and, you know, would go on to win the championship that year. The O's won that game 4-2, and the other games was against Minnesota I went to in August, which is also somewhat of note because Cal got tossed in the first inning of that game, which ended his consecutive innings played streak. But
not games.
I guess not games. Yeah. I guess, like, even though he didn't play five innings, whatever the rule was, like, he started, he played, and he got thrown out for arguing balls and strikes in the bottom of the first. So, yeah, we went all the way up there. It was like I was at a sports camp, and they took us up by bus that afternoon, and we all got excited, and then our everybody's favorite player and the team's best player gets tossed in the first inning. So that part is memorable. And then I went to a game against Cleveland, you know, during the pennant race in September, where they got whitewashed, but actually it's somewhat well known because it was the debut for Ben McDonald, who had just been drafted a couple months earlier, who was the first overall pick, was kind of the Steven Strasburg of his day, you know, was really hyped and had held out for a little while, so they didn't make his debut until that game in September. And also making his first start of the season that night was none other than Kurt Schilling, who was, you know, an O's prospect at the time. Those are the games that I went to. Those are the only ones I went to. It was Memorial that year, so it was a little bit further. You know, they hadn't moved in.
It's not Camden Yards. Camden Yards open in
92, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. My bad.
So it was still Memorial. It was, and it was, even from Rockville, it was a hike, you know, on a weekend, it wasn't bad. You could, you know, make it there in roughly an hour and then maybe stop at the harbor, or whatever, and do the touristy stuff. But like, you know, forget about going there on a weekday. So actually going to that Cleveland game that McDonald debuted in September was on a weeknight. So it was really,
wow.
Yeah, it was a real privilege. That just shows how important, I mean, I think it was, not just to me, but my father who took me. It was a big game. And so he took me after work, and I don't know how long it took us, but we went up there. You know, maybe the only weeknight game I ever attended during the school year at Memorial Stadium.
Yeah, I went to Memorial Stadium once or twice, and I just remember it was a much further reach towards the northeast side of town, and you definitely had to go through some more interesting neighborhoods on the way there. And it was a stadium that was built to go watch a baseball game and not much fucking else. Uh-huh. It was dark. It was functional. And you were there to watch Orioles baseball. And that was it. Camden Yards is a wonderland by comparison. It's also on the south part of the market. So for the D.C. market, much easier to zip on up and hit it to get in there and get out. So that summer, you also were... You had a lot of things going on in your life. Let's just put it that way. Walk us through some of the other things that 11-year-old Ryan was dealing with as the Orioles were painting this magical picture of a season nobody expected.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of started early in the season, you know, around May. My grandmother got diagnosed, you know, grandmother was very close with, maternal grandmother got diagnosed with terminal cancer, was given only about 6 months to live. The same time I had our family pet, our cat was very sick, you know, was kind of on his last legs. So dealing with that. And then I found out around the last week of the school year, you know, I had been going to public school, Ritchie Park, you know, in the Rockville area since kindergarten with the same kids, a lot of the same friends since kindergarten. And I thought I'd be going to junior high school with them, but the school board had changed the boundaries a year earlier. We were supposed to go to Frost Junior High and then Wooten High School, and they changed the boundaries about a year earlier, and then we were kind of we're going to go to Julius West, Richard Montgomery. So my mom, as a lot of parents did, decided that you know, she was just going to pull me out and send me to private school. So I just didn't really find out until you know very end of the school year. Yeah, I was a little bit of denial kind of helped me there, because obviously I had to go to the schools and like take the tours and, you know, take the admittance test and all that, but they. Parents were a little bit dishonest to me, telling me they just, you know, we want to see just where you measure up. Like they didn't want to freak me out until basically the last possible second. So I find out, you know, in June, as the O's are going on this incredible run to take over first place, that like suddenly, you know, you're not going to Julius West next year. You're not going to be with your friends. We're sending you to this private school that, you know, was a school that I didn't like when I had visited, where I knew one kid, you know, a kid who... of course, I played baseball with before for a couple of years on my little league team. So all that's going on. And like at the same time, you know, I started puberty unbeknownst to me, you know, because you don't really know it. You're going through it
at 11,
especially the beginning at 11, you know, very, very early signs. And kind of the signs were like, I have a vivid memory of sleeping in one day. Like, you know, I used to just get up and we didn't start the school day till 9. And I used to just get up and kind of hang out, eat breakfast, whatever, and then we would walk to school with friends. But it was one morning when my mom had to wake me up, and I remember waking up with her kind of this like sad look on her face, because obviously she realized what was going on, but I didn't, and I had to kind of rush out the door that day. And so along with, I think, this onset of puberty came all of a sudden these anxiety disorders that, you know, I now know what was going on. I now know it was, you know, generalized anxiety disorder and panic disorder that just kind of hit me out of the blue. But at the time, I had no idea. You know, nobody was talking about this. And I just suddenly felt like, you know, something was going on in my head. And I couldn't figure out why I suddenly felt very different than I had, you know, just a couple months earlier. I had, you know, a pretty massive panic attack in Hebrew school a few months earlier, but had managed to kind of kick that out of my mind. And then the generalized anxiety started to set in. So I thought, you know, part of me thought that I might be crazy, and obviously didn't want to deal with it. So I'm kind of like having these panics, and sometimes would have episodes and would feel very different, even during in my own baseball games, like didn't want recognition all of a sudden, right. You know, whereas I had been as a much younger kid had been very much about that, you know, I really loved being the center of attention when I was younger, and all of a sudden it was just completely flipped. So yeah, dealing with all that. And it all kind of started right around May, June, you know, right in the middle of that season.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot going on there, but I bet amidst all of it, you're like, okay, but Mickey Tettleton just hit another home run. How great is that? I'm looking at the lineup here, and I know you could have named it off, just rattled it off easily, but I'm not going to pop quiz you. Mickey Tettleton behind the plate. Jim Traber at first. Traber was John Kruk before John Kruk. Like, just a good old boy, tank ass, could hit for power, great character player. Rene Gonzalez at second, Craig Worthington at third, Cal at short, Phil Bradley, Brady Anderson in center. That was before he erupted for his 51 home run year. Steve Finley in right field. DH Larry Sheets, who was the epitome of a late 80s DH in baseball. Mustache, big biceps, didn't hit for contact, but could rake. And then Dave Schmidt was probably your best starting pitcher. Am I missing anybody from that team that was significant?
Yeah, so Billy Ripken also was in the mix there at second. And this was obviously Cal's younger brother. You had Mike Devereaux came over from the Dodgers during the offseason and played a lot in the outfield in his rookie year. Randy Milligan came over from a trade from the Mets in the offseason, was his rookie year. So he played a lot of first as well. Guys like Joe Worsalek, like speaking of, you know, kind of quintessential late 80s guy who hung around for a while. And Craig, I think you mentioned Worthington, right? The third baseman.
Yeah, yeah.
His rookie year. Yeah. Yeah, and then you have guys like the whole pitching staff. Just, you know, you mentioned Schmidt. He was the opening day starter. And he was the only guy really with any kind of credential. I think he was the – I don't think they had a single pitcher going into the season who ever won, you know, at least 10 games in a season in that rotation. And you had guys like Jeff Ballard, who had been – up and down from the minors for a couple of years, who ended up winning 18 games that year. Easily could have won 20 if not for a couple of bullpen meltdowns late. And then, you know, rookies like Pete Harnish, Bob Mulacky.
Oh.
And then the emergence of Dave Johnson coming up, this career minor leaguer coming up in August when they desperately needed anybody who could, you know, get some outs and eat some innings. And they throw him out there, and it's his first full week in the season of the, you know, his career in the big leagues, he's named player of the week.
It's amazing.
And ends up starting in the last weekend. Yeah. So, you know, all kinds of guys coming out of nowhere. And then, of course, I think you mentioned Olson, right? The closer, who was also a rookie, Greg Olson.
Yeah.
Who got some, even though he didn't take the closer role full time until sometime in May, saved 27 games and went something like 2 months without allowing a run, and even earned some MVP votes for his performance
he did
that year.
MVP 12. So he finished 12th. Yep. He was in the voting there and comeback player of the year. He got some votes for that as well. So, yeah, good stuff there. So I would imagine, and by the way, these type of teams don't happen in any sport but baseball. The random odd collection that gels, that the sum of the parts is way bigger than adding up the individual players, right? Like, there's not teams like this in basketball where, like, we had no idea the 85 Sonics were going to be good and they just came together. It only happens in baseball. Baseball is beautiful that way. That's why baseball movies outnumber football movies and basketball movies 10-1, because it truly is a weird sort of magic that you never quite account for. I would imagine as well for you, that summer was the greatest summer ever, even though you're going through a lot, because you had this team you could follow every single day and be into every single day and get to know the players every day and be super into it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was easily my favorite baseball season to follow, no doubt. And like, and to that point, the greatest season that I had seen. You know, it was the first year that I really followed a team that closely. You know, even though I'd already been following baseball for about 3 years and was a pretty big baseball nut to that point, I never got indoctrinated into a team like that before or since. I mean, it was because, like you mentioned, it was like so ridiculous what happened. It was so unexpected. And, you know, I was a fifth grader when it started, right? So, like, part of me still kind of believed in fairy tales. Like, this is not that long after Miracle on Ice.
Well, you're 11, why wouldn't you believe in that stuff? I would.
Yeah.
I know I did.
And it had happened. Like, stuff like that had happened before. You know, you'd had, like, Tom Boswell, who wrote, obviously, very often during that season, would often, and I read in my research, read a lot of his columns, would reference the 67 Red Sox and the Impossible Dream and some of these other teams like the Whiz Kids Phillies from 1950 or I think 1950. So there was precedent, you know, and the Miracle on Ice was less than a decade old. And so like it was very much believable that this miracle could happen. You know, and as like a little kid, when a lot of things had gone right in my life to that point and had like a pretty, you know, I would say a pretty carefree childhood up until that point, up until that May or June, like had no reason not to believe, like not only could this happen, but it was going to happen, you know, and certainly by the All-Star break, as they're sitting there 7.5 games up, it's like, okay, this is, yeah, this is definitely going to happen. We're going to be playing, you know, the A's in an epic ALCS series, like the Mighty Athletics, like the true underdogs, you know, we're going to get the epilogue to Major League that we didn't get to see what it would happen.
Up seven games with how many to play?
There were still quite a lot of games. I mean, there was 70-ish, I think, yeah, around then, because then they collapsed. They lost 13 out of 14 in late July.
Okay.
Olsen was out. There were some other guys banged up, and they had lost some close games.
So they ran it up to seven games, but it's early in the season. It's still mid-season, so you're not counting any chickens at that point. But then they crash, but then they stabilize. Mm-hmm. And they were in it right up until the last weekend. We forgot the 69 Mets, the Miracle
yes.
Mets. Shocking.
Yeah.
Winning the World Series, as known as the lovable losers, winning 100 regular season games and beat the heavily favored Orioles mm-hmm. in five games, the Miracle Mets in 69. So mm-hmm. I got to ask you this. I mean, I assume you're still a big diehard Orioles fan, yeah?
No.
Oh, no! Shocker! Wow.
No, I mean, I'm a DC area native. You know, I grew up rooting for all.
When the Nats came to town, did you switch?
I did, yeah.
Okay. You know,
I don't
fault that. That to me is fine.
Switch is not the operative word, though. You know, I went off to college late 90s, and that the O's really started to suck then, and they were not on TV yeah. as much. There's no MLB package or whatever. It's not that a college student could have afforded such a thing. So, you know, and by the time I started trying to watch him again, I didn't recognize anybody on the team. And then I wasn't living locally anyway.
Yeah.
So there were a few years there where they were still my favorite team, but I didn't really follow any major league team. And then, like you said, the Nats got here. And at the same time, too, like, you know, even before the Nats got here, you know, the Angelos family was fighting.
Oh, yeah.
And it was pretty widely reported. They were right. So it became pretty difficult to root for a team that was owned by the Angelos family. And then the whole Masson squabble that started once the Nats got here just solidified, like, you know, any thought I might have had about going back to being an O's fan.
Well, I know,
just got disappeared.
Yeah, I know several Oriole fan diehards. And whenever I talk to them when I play golf about the O's, they're so into it. And I was actually at the last great Orioles playoff moment when they beat the Tigers. With the bases clearing double by, I forget who it was, for the Orioles against the Tigers. Incredible scene. I had tickets to the game. I took my buddy Johnny up. I'm like, let's go and go to the game. And it was amazing. And since then, they've had really good teams, especially the last 5 years. And they have stepped straight on their you-know-whats every mm-hmm. postseason. I feel for diehard Oriole fans because they should be rewarded more, but that's not how baseball works, unfortunately, which is both the charm and the curse of it. So would you, as a baseball fan, go back to the days of simple East-West, one division winner only, or are you okay with the now expanded playoffs?
Yeah, I'm okay with the expanded playoffs. If anything, I might expand the playoffs just a little bit.
More?
In the sense of, like, I wouldn't add more teams. I do like how they have more game. I think the division series, yeah, should probably go to seven. Like, if you think about it, that's the equivalent of, like, you know, the second round in hockey or the NBA playoffs. And, you know, could you imagine, like, a conference semifinal in the NHL or NBA being only best of five?
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember when there used to be best of threes. And I believe the NBA had best of threes once upon a time. So, yeah. Problem is, the TV networks don't want more product at that time. They're like, look, you can do whatever you want, but we only want so many baseball games. We like baseball. We pay this much. We don't want this much inventory. So I think that's going to be basically pushing it. So as a Nat fan, real quick, mm-hmm. did you enjoy the highs of the World Series year and have you suffered through this latest ongoing rebuild? And I would say the Nationals this year, Ryan, are having a bit of a pop-up surprise season. It's not a miracle yet, but holy shit, they're outperforming expectations, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could draw some parallels between this team and the 89 O's team. Just in the sense that they weren't expected to do anything, and most people picked them to lose like 90 games or more, which they could still do, by the way. They're only at 500. But it's, yeah, I mean, they certainly have exceeded expectations. Like, it's been fun to watch them, at least on offense, like leading the, I think they lead MLB now in runs, right? And certainly the NL. I mean, that was really unexpected, especially when you got like Dylan Cruz isn't even hitting and Brady House had to get sent down to the minors. It's like two guys kind of expecting to be in a lineup every day and to be at least doing something in that lineup. And then, you know, certainly didn't expect guys like Nunez and or even Damon Lyle or guys like that to be doing anything. K-Bear having a bounce back season. So it's been fun to watch, although, I mean, watching some of these games, it's almost like you want to turn it off in the eighth inning, especially whenever they have the lead. You know,
yeah,
because you just don't know what's going to happen with that bullpen.
Yeah, the closers are atrocious. They mm-hmm. don't even deserve to be called closers. So they're kind of like game throwers. Like, okay, well, whatever happened, guess what? We're going to fuck it all up right now. Just sit tight. We got it covered.
Yeah, that Philly series a couple weeks ago was brutal. I ended up watching the end, I mean, of all three of those games. And just like, why didn't I turn this game on earlier and just like, I could have watched this take the lead instead of blow it.
Yeah. The book is called Death of a Childhood, a memoir of 1989 and the Why Not Baltimore Orioles. Ryan Basin, author. Basin? I should have asked.
You got it. Yeah, Basin is right. Yeah.
Ryan Basin, author. It's available on Amazon, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble Bookshop, wherever books are sold. You can also get the ebook as well at iTunes and other places. Just look for it. Death of a Childhood. It is not that grim. It is just about a magical year for an 11-year-old boy from Rockville, Maryland, the sister city to Pinneberg, Germany, loving his baseball team, riding or dying, and coming oh so close. And that's the stuff of life right there. That's the stuff of baseball. So it's good stuff. Good luck with the book going forward, and it was great to connect.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
All right, one more thing to end on today. So I've never shopped Temu. I know what it is. Chinese-based mega seller that often sells very cheap items, but also sells odd items as well. I saw an ad that did get me to click, which means now I'm never going to get out of the honey trap of Temu-sponsored ads on my social media, timeline, browser, etc. But I did click on a shipping crate swimming pool from Temu. Order now. I'm like, what? They had some nicely done AI rendering of what in theory could be done, which is to take a giant metal shipping container, 8 feet wide, 10 feet high, 40 feet long, seal it up, make sure all the, you know, corners and open doors are grouted, shut, sealed, fill it with water, build a deck around it, and then boom, you got a swimming pool. I'm like, really? This is a thing. So I couldn't resist. I like clicked on it. Sure enough, Temu said shipping container, $9,563, which I hope includes shipping. I would imagine the actual metal is less than that. It's just it costs a lot of money to get this claptrap delivered to your door. But I'm like, okay. But it didn't really show you like, and here's the kit to convert it into a swimming pool. Here's what you're going to need. You're going to need this sealant. You're going to need this support beam. You're going to need this leveler. You're going to need this thing to scrub out some of the toxins that are in the inside of the container that'll be in your pool. Oh, you're also going to need X 100,000 gallons of water, which is not going to be easy. So you got to do that as well. None of that. But I just have two questions. A, has anyone ever ordered anything weird, expensive, or huge off of Temu? And how does that work? And are you happy? And secondly, Temu or not, have you ever made a swimming pool out of something unconventional, like a shipping container?
and how easy and or hard and or how smart or and or how stupid is it? I welcome your responses at zabe@yahoo.com. That's enough for me today. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate and review. Spread the word. When you do gamble, please gamble responsibly, but make sure to gamble at mybookie.com, the original sports book that takes care of their customers, not trying to flim-flam you or get you trapped in anything. They just want you to have fun, have a little money on the game, and then when you win, be able to cash out and go spend that money on a nice dinner for you and your girl. MyBookie.com, promo code ZABE, Charlie, Zulu, Alpha, Bravo, Echo. Thanks for listening. Have yourself a great Thursday, and we will see you next time.
Stopped into a church, I passed along the way.
The playoffs are here, people. NBA and NHL both going at the same time. That's the best 2 weeks in the sports calendar, right? And it goes fast. More games, more angles, more ways to be right, and more ways to win. That's the fun. MyBookie.ag has it all. And right now, for new players, use promo code ZABE on your first deposit. And if your first bet doesn't hit, they refund it up to $500 back as free play one-time rollover, plus $25 in casino credit automatically. That's called insurance, my friends. MyBookie.ag, promo code ZABE. Check the site for offer details and to confirm availability in your state. Bet smart, get paid.